Good morning. The court's ready to hear argument in Anderson v. State. Are you ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
Very well.
Good morning.
Good morning. It's nice to see you back in your old law school.
Yes, as well. May it please the court, Santino Chakotay on behalf of the appellant in this case, and that is Valerie Anderson. There are two arguments we make to this court. First, that the Court of Common Pleas was within its authority and discretion to vacate its own judgment after reliance upon what it found to be a misrepresentation by the state during the habitual offender calendar. The second argument we make is that the Court of Common Pleas actions were also appropriate in light of the fact that the state has exceeded its statutory authority by engaging in selective enforcement of 21 Delaware Code 2804. The record in the instant case reflects that the Superior Court's description below of the sidebar and the representations therein are misconstrued. In particular, the state and the Superior Court take exception to the bracketed language that the Court of Common Pleas uses in its opinion. The Superior Court found that the colloquy was simply a mere misunderstanding. But if to understand why the Court of Common Pleas made its finding, it's necessary to elaborate as to the context that occurred during the habitual offender calendar. As we emphasize in our papers here and in our papers below, the state had offered numerous standard continuances throughout the habitual offender calendar. Prior to the colloquy with the DAG, the court, based on the Attorney General's request for a continuance for a Mr. Lucian Chandler, called the Attorney General to sidebar to request why that same continuance could not be offered to Ms. Anderson. It was at that point that the Attorney General proceeded to explain that such a continuance had already been given. After the calendar had concluded, the judge went back into chambers to determine whether these representations were accurate and determined that they in fact were not. This is what led to vacating the order for Ms. Anderson. The standard of review here is critical.
Well, before we move on, the judge didn't simply vacate the order. He had also denied the state's application to have her declared to be a habitual offender. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor. But a close look at that order actually indicates that they requested the Attorney General's office to resubmit the petition at a later time before the same judge. So whereas the state paints the picture that Ms. Anderson would at some point simply not be a habitual offender, that position is misplaced. The offer was made to re-present the petition at a later time, which was not done, and that's where the appeal initiated from that point forward.
Wouldn't a subsequent petition on the very same grounds be barred as res judicata or not?
I don't believe so. Respectfully, the way the state is handling these calendars or these petitions is they're withdrawing them and they're incentivizing the respondents to either improve their driving record, and if that's the case, they'll withdraw it. So at this point, what's happening is the state is exercising its discretion. What's so problematic about that, though, is the plain reading of 2804 strips the state of any discretion whatsoever in these proceedings. They don't have the discretion. And this is what the Court of Common Pleas had trouble understanding during the calendar, is it's stripping the discretion from the trial judge, essentially making them a notary, and giving the discretion solely to the Attorney General's office to determine how and who was going to be a habitual driving offender.
Mr. Picotti, I'm struggling here just to understand, in clear terms, what it is we're being asked to decide. Let me see if I understand your side's position correctly.
Certainly.
Let's put to one side the whole issue of whether or not there was a misrepresentation. As I understand it, you're making an argument that flows from a statutory command. That is, the statute requires that when a when the conditions for habitual drunken driver,
a driving offender, sure.
When that status is achieved, then the statute mandates that the Attorney General bring charges to have that person declared habitual. That hasn't been done here. That is, the Attorney General has picked and chosen which
cases. Correct. That's correct.
It will bring rather than bringing them all. Therefore, the court has the discretion to deny any relief at all to the Attorney General because the Attorney General hasn't followed the statutory command. Is that your side's position?
Not to an extent, yes. To be clear, the appellant's position is that the statute not only strips away the discretion from the state, but it's silent on the issue of whether the court has discretion in these hearings and what authority they have. Because of its silence, it is our position that the court does have discretion in these hearings.
But the court has discretion to deny relief to the Attorney General because the statute requires the Attorney General to charge in all cases that qualify.
That's correct.
And there's nothing in the statute that denies the court the discretion to not to grant relief to the Attorney General. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Is that your position, regardless of the outcome of this misrepresentation?
Yes, it is. And to elaborate on that point, Your Honor, when the General Assembly wants to prohibit the court from any type of discretion, they've prospectively done so. This court need only look to the 11 Delaware Code 4205 Section D, in which it classifies sentences for felonies. And what it does is, a careful look at that, is it denies the court any authority to modify any of those sentences. So when the General Assembly wants to limit the authority of the court, they say it.
Well, would you agree that a remedy for a violation of a legal rule has to have some rational relationship, if not reasonable relationship, to the violation?
Sure.
You're contending here the court's discretionary dismissal of what would otherwise be an incontestable habitual charge is a proper remedy, that is an allowable remedy, correct?
If I'm misquoting, Your Honor, the remedy being the dismissal of the petition altogether?
Well, let me ask you differently. What is the rational relationship between the violation, which is not charging in all cases that literally qualify, and the remedy, which is dismissal of the charges that were brought in one particular case?
Well, the relationship is the fact that, as the Court of Common Pleas elaborated, if we adopt the Superior Court and the state's position on this issue, you have unfettered discretion by a party to a case where the judicial officer in charge is essentially a moderator and has no authority at all.
Let me see if I understand how your theory works. Let's suppose that there are 100 cases that qualify for the mandatory, under the mandatory statutory rule requiring the Attorney General to bring charges. So there should have been 100 cases filed. Let's assume that the Attorney General brings 99 charges, but not the last one, the 100th. Does the court have discretion to dismiss or to deny relief in the 99 cases that were brought?
For the first 99, where the requirements were met?
I'm just asking. I mean, that seems to be a logical consequence of the theory that you're asking.
Sure. I think what is fundamental here, though, is besides the statutory requirements, there is judicial inherent authority. I think this court has explained in Sloman that the court, you know, in order for there to be, you know, in fact, if the court looks at Sloman, in particular the language therein, it's a basic principle of jurisprudence that courts are afforded inherent judicial authority. So whereas in those 99, we probably need more facts to determine what exactly was on the record, what was said. This is why the misrepresentation is so important.
So you're saying, are you suggesting that there weren't enough facts on the record for the Court of Common Pleas to exercise the discretion that it in fact exercised?
No, there were enough facts on the record. There were more than enough facts to determine that once the misrepresentation occurred on the record, it contaminated the hearing altogether. And when it contaminated the hearing, the court went back into chambers to determine what is in play here when the habitual offender calendar is before the court. What role do they have? And the state has brought, what's ironic here is that this argument is not new to the state. They've brought the same argument in Sloman, where a modification of a sentence order was challenged from a task center case manager, and the court said it was an illegal sentence modification. And this court stood by its principle of inherent judicial authority to affirm the modification.
But the principles involving inherent authority do not extend so far as to allow the court to act contrary to an express statute. That's assuming it's a constitutional statute, does it?
No, that's correct, Your Honor. But in this statute, it's silent as to what inherent authority the judicial officer has in habitual offender proceedings.
But doesn't the statute require the court, when the respondent has been identified correctly and when the respondent has certain prior convictions, to declare the respondent an habitual offender and revoke his license and actually collect it on the spot?
Yes, but what the statute doesn't say is probably more important, and that is it doesn't provide anything regarding the suspension of the civil penalty. It doesn't provide anything regarding its inherent judicial authority or whether it can modify such a sentence. When the General Assembly has made specific, for example, in 4205D, which involves the felony statutes, it specifically prescribes that those sentences cannot be modified or suspended. It specifically indicates that. When it's silent, it's safe to assume it's silent for a reason. The General Assembly did not put it in there purposefully. That's what gives the judicial officer in this situation the authority to have any type of, if we adopt the alternative, we're making the judicial officer in these cases nothing more than a notary. They're just rubber stamping every petition that comes before them. However, the state is controlling the proceeding, because they're controlling whose petition gets submitted, which petition gets a six-month continuance, or which petition gets withdrawn altogether.
And that happened to your client's benefit, is that correct, at one point, where the Judge Abelman says the prior petition against Anderson had been dismissed entirely, and she contrasted that with other respondents on the calendar merely receiving continuances. And she says the state's exercise of discretion towards Anderson, when viewed in full context, was more lenient than towards other respondents identified by the court below. Is that accurate or not?
No, it's not. It's not accurate, because the state will concede, as Judge Abelman concedes in her opinion, that the state routinely gives standard six-month continuances. Ms. Anderson's previous petition was withdrawn. The record is unclear for what reason the state withdrew it, but the misrepresentation stems from the fact that the Attorney General was asked whether Ms. Anderson received a standard continuance. She has not. She has not.
Time interval between the withdrawal of the prior petition and the September 25, 2009 calendar? Is it 6 months or more?
From the time that...
Of the prior petition.
I have to look at the timeline. I believe that it was within the 6 months, but I'm not sure how that affects any of the, whether the state, you know, they withdrew the petition, and there was no standard continuance given.
Let me go back to Justice Jacobs' question. What's your position with regard to this 99 out of 100? If there are 100 people eligible to be proceeded against by the state, and the state files 100, but with regard to the last one, the state says, we'd like to give them the standard continuance, and if things go well, we'll probably withdraw the petition.
Sure.
If the state doesn't go forward with all 100, is it your position that it cannot go forward with the 99, or what is your position?
My position is that that precise example is in contravention of the statutory mandatory language, and therefore they're violating the same law that they're trying to enforce.
All right.
Well, I guess prompts me to ask maybe in a different form my original question, and that is how do you articulate the rational relationship between the wrong and the remedy? The wrong here is that the statute requires the state to bring charges in all of the cases that qualify under the statutory criteria. The wrong is that the state is not doing that. It is cherry-picking.
That's right.
Picking and choosing which cases it decides to charge. How does the court dismissing cases that were brought by the state in accordance with the statute rationally contribute to curing that wrong?
Because as the Court of Common Pleas succinctly stated, if that were adopted, the state would have discretion to proceed against the respondents, but the application of their discretion would not be subject to review. That's the rational relationship. There's no review. If they're exercising their discretion, they're controlling the proceeding.
Well, there is at least the opportunity to make a selective prosecution equal protection argument and put in the record sufficient information to support that type of claim, isn't there?
No, and we can see that this isn't about due process. We're not arguing that there's a due process violation. We understand that. The error here is the abuse of discretion by the state, which is going against respondents who are not receiving standard continuances. And to compound that even further, you have misrepresentations on the record to assuage the court of the very concerns that the Court of Common Pleas had on the day of the calendar. I see I'm approaching my time. If,
Well, we've used up your rebuttal time with questions, so the court will give you the 3 minutes you requested.
I appreciate it, Your Honor. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Wallace. If
good morning, Your Honor.
You need an additional 3 minutes, you can certainly have it also.
I'm hoping I won't, Your Honor. Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, Paul Wallace on behalf of the state. At its core, as the Superior Court found, this case is all about separation of powers. Now, Valerie Anderson doesn't want to recognize the fact that the state is an executive agency and needs to make executive enforcement decisions. Just as it does in all other matters, the Attorney General will decide whether or not to bring charges or not to bring charges.
Except that in this case, the legislature has deprived the Attorney General of the right to decide. It says, thou shalt bring charges. And yet the Attorney General hasn't done that in all cases where the legislature says it should.
Your Honor,
are you contending that that aspect of the legislation is a violation of the separation of powers provision?
And if
you are, then why hasn't that been done in a proper way?
Your Honor, I am not saying that there is a violation of separation of powers in the language that the legislature has used. I disagree that that's how that language should be interpreted. And I'd suggest that if you look at, for instance, probably the most...
You're saying shall doesn't mean shall.
It means that's the manner in which the state must do it. If you look, for instance, at 11 Delaware Code 4214, the habitual criminal offender petition statute, 4215B is the one that actually sets forth the procedure for it. What it says is when it appears to the Attorney General that a person is an habitual offender, they shall file a petition with the court.
Shall.
Yes, but we all know. In fact, this court's case law says that it's up to the state to determine whether or not it is going to file an habitual criminal petition. We do in some cases.
What does the language in the statute we're dealing with today say?
In the language in the statute we are dealing with today, specifically says the Attorney General, upon receiving the abstract from the Director of Department of Motor Vehicles, shall forthwith file a petition against the person named therein. Compare that to 4214. If it shall appear to the Attorney General a defendant should be subjected to subsection 4214 of this title, the Attorney General shall file a motion. What it's saying is, in order to start the proceedings, the Attorney General, that's the mandatory manner. It must file a petition to start the proceedings. But it's not stripping away the discretion of the Attorney General to make the enforcement decisions that it makes in every other context it does, either criminal or civil enforcement.
But how do you get to that from the plain language of the statute? And the argument that we're hearing is that the way this statute is written, when you get the information from the motor vehicle department, you have no discretion. You need to take it at face value, file the petition. And then when the petition's filed, people can argue about prior convictions and whatever they want to argue about, but that simply upon receipt of the information, the Attorney General has to file the petition.
I suggest that I differ with the court in how the shall is used in this particular circumstance, that it's not saying the state must file the petition.
I'm not taking a position. You know, I'm asking a question. Obviously, the Court of Common Pleas and the Superior Court divided. I want you to tell us what language in this statute, where do you find discretion? I understand the 4214 argument now related to this statute.
I simply interpret it the same way I would interpret, I'm sorry, it was 4215B,
right,
which is the one I was analogizing it to. Both use shall, both operate in the same manner. And that is, it describes how the state must proceed, that it must use a petition, but not that it must proceed. I think that's the difference in both of them. That in both cases, it's saying, when you proceed, you shall use the petition to do so. but not that you must proceed in both, because that would, in such an interpretation, would impinge on the executive function of the Attorney General.
Let me see if I have your position down correctly. You're distinguishing between actually filing the petition and proceeding with the petition once it's filed.
No, I apologize. I was unclear then. I am distinguishing between whether or not the statute is saying you shall proceed, meaning you must move forward with this action under certain circumstances, as opposed to when you do decide to proceed, you shall file a petition, that's the mandatory manner in which you must well, bring the action, because you shall proceed.
Let me ask it a different way. Has the Attorney General, in fact, filed petitions in 100% of the cases where they receive certifications from the Division of Motor Vehicles that a particular individual satisfies the criteria for a habitual offender?
No, I'm sure we have not.
All right. So if we were to disagree with your interpretation of the statute, that is, were we to conclude that as a matter of proper statutory interpretation, the statute requires the AG to file a petition in 100% of those cases, we have basically the AG defaulting on that obligation. It's a matter of logic, correct?
If that's the court's interpretation, right. Yes.
What would, and in that circumstance, what is the remedy? That is, how does the Attorney General made to account for not observing the command of the legislature?
But let me first apply it to this case. There is no remedy to Valerie Anderson, because such a statutory violation makes absolutely no difference to her. She cannot show one statutory violation that applies to her case.
I'm not asking you to talk about this case.
In general,
yes.
Because it's an executive function, Your Honor, it would be the same as if the Attorney General didn't meet any of his other obligations. It's a political decision. The people of this state are his and eventual bosses in that regard, and will determine whether or not they believe he is following the statute.
Okay, so you're saying there's no legal remedy. If there is a remedy, it's in the political realm.
Yes, because it is a wholly executive function to make that decision, the state suggests.
As I understand your position, well, you'll agree, won't you, that at least an interpretation of the statute is that shall means shall and it's mandatory.
That the state must file all petitions.
And if the state must file, that's a potential interpretation of the statute, correct?
I have to say that yes. If reasonable minds have differed on it,
another interpretation is that it's procedural only, and which would not involve a separation of powers issue, and therefore the construction that should be made should be one that upholds the constitutionality of the statute.
Yes, the latter interpretation mean is to describe the procedure that the state must follow when it determines to go forward. And that would avoid any possible constitutional issue as far as these.
So is this one of those rare but possible circumstances where shall really means may?
No. I think it means shall because it's procedural. Because it tells us that is the procedure by which the state has to move forward. It cannot move forward in any way but filing a petition once the decision to move forward is made.
But you're making a very finely calibrated distinction. Is that a distinction that's argued in your brief?
No, and the reason for it is this, Your Honor. Quite frankly, the state believes, first of all, that there is no statutory violation because of that interpretation. Two, if there was any type of statutory violation, it doesn't affect Valerie Anderson in one way, shape, or form. And three, if we get to the statutory violation, let's assume for a moment that there's a statutory violation, we get to the very problem that Justice Jacobs has spoken about, and that is, how does this remedy that Valerie Anderson come up with make any sense? If, in fact, the state is violating the statute by not moving forward or proceeding once it's filed a motion or not bringing a motion to begin with, the remedy isn't for the Court of Common Pleas to say, let me get in on that then. Let me tell you when you can violate the statute. It should be, stop violating the statute. And here, the court had every ability to do that by saying, I won't grant that continuance. It violates the statute. But that's not what Valerie Anderson and the Court of Common Pleas wanted to do here. Instead, what they wanted to say is, State, I don't like the way you are exercising your discretion. And that's the real core executive problem here, the real core separation of powers problem here.
But I think we have to draw some lines. When we say that the executive has discretion to charge, that's pretty clear. But once a charging decision has been made, and then there's judicial involvement, we look at it somewhat differently. So in this particular case, we have a decision made to charge the person as a habitual offender. But then what the state seems to be saying routinely is, Your Honor, we don't want you to act on this petition for 6 months. That's the standard procedure. And during that time, the person's record may improve, and we may come back here and tell you we'd like you to dismiss the petition or whatever you want to do. You need the court to agree with your application, don't you?
Absolutely.
And so there, we're not talking about your discretion any longer. We're talking about whether the court should agree to give you a continuance, give the state a continuance.
Well, I believe that the first step is a matter of discretion for the parties or for the state to request the continuance. The second is one, yes, certainly it needs judicial approval to do so. And the problem...
And so in this case, what the court's saying is, you know, we see these applications after you've made the charging decision, and I'm concerned about what I perceive to be a disparity in the applications. Isn't that a legitimate question for a court to ask?
I suggest it is not unless there is some reason to believe that it's discriminatory in some way. What happened here, and we have to go back, there's been much said of misrepresentation and what was said. I suggest that the court needs to look at exactly what was said, and more importantly, what was said by the Court of Common Pleas in vacating.
We have looked at that, and I think Judge Abelman made a rational observation about what happened there. There was not a decision to charge in January, and when the deputy was asked after the fact in this case about why they didn't make the same offer, I think your argument is a reasonable interpretation of what happened, that the deputy said, we gave her a break before. And giving her a break before didn't necessarily mean we gave her the standard continuance before. It meant we gave her a break before.
Right.
So that's not in dispute. What we're trying to figure out here is this idea of discretion. And let's assume hypothetically we agree with your position on the record. We agree that the Attorney General has discretion to make the charge. We're now beyond that, where you've charged the person as a habitual offender, and you want the court to grant your motion. If the court is seeing a lot of motions, isn't it legitimate for the court to say, you know, I'm discerning a pattern here that gives me pause?
If the pattern that gives the court pause is that there's some constitutional violation, such as equal protection, such as discrimination, improper selective enforcement based on vindictiveness or something like that, then absolutely I suggest the court steps in. And that's clear in the law. That's not what happened here.
But we're just trying to understand the ground rules. So you agree
that
we're no longer talking about the attorney's general's discretion. We're talking about a legitimate concern the court could have, but there are boundaries on what constitute legitimate concerns.
Yes, exactly. And I'd suggest that in this case, it's the state's position that this was not a legitimate concern, that the court shouldn't say, I'm looking at the records now. I'm getting back, because what that's doing is stepping back really to that charging decision question that courts are loath to get into because of all of the factors. Look what happened in this case.
Well, no, the charging decision has already been made. So we're not looking at the charging decision. We're looking at what the court should do after the charging decision has been made and the Attorney General says to the court, I've charged the person, but I'd like a continuance, and I would like time to think about how we're going to proceed. So we're not talking about the charging decision.
I understand, except to a certain extent, what the court does when, like I said, if the court looks at factors that may raise suspicion of true discrimination or something that's constitutionally protected, that's one thing. But here, for instance, when the court looks at factors such as, I don't think you're treating this driver with this record the same as you're treating what I believe to be a driver with the same record, that, I suggest, actually does get back into that almost charging function, because that looks at a bunch of factors that generally courts say they should not get into in trying to determine it. The courts have been very clear on drawing the lines at, for instance, equal protection and true discrimination, but loath to get into that underlying decision as to whether or not this person is deserving of prosecution. That's really the executive function in the beginning.
Two questions, one hypothetical, I'm sorry, one factual and the other hypothetical.
That's right.
Just as a factual matter in these types of proceedings, once the Attorney General brings a charge, is it correct that there are a limited number of challenges that the defendant can make in the Court of Common Pleas?
Yes, actually there's only two, and if you look at 2807, it's basically, I'm not that guy, or that's not my record.
Okay.
Other than that, there's
the
really nothing
else. The DMV got it wrong, these predicate charges
yes.
are not against me. But what you're also suggesting is there are at least two other defenses that could be raised, but they're at the constitutional level. One of them is basically discrimination in bringing these charges in violation of the Equal Protection Clause, or vindictive prosecution in violation of the Due Process Clause. Correct?
Yes, absolutely. I believe that those are wholly...
Okay. Would it have been procedurally proper for that issue to be brought before the Court of Common Pleas by the Court of Common Pleas, for example, this is the hypothetical, sua sponte, issuing an order to the state to show cause why a particular charge shouldn't be dismissed because there has been, you know, some unconstitutionality in the bringing of the claim?
I do think that two things could occur. I think that a defendant could raise that claim in defending himself or herself against the petition. I do think that in the extraordinary circumstance where, you know, a judge is sitting there and let's say we have the 100 petitions again, and the state has, you know, 99 people of one race and moves one way, and one of another race and the state moves another way that's to that person's detriment, I certainly think that it is the place of a judicial officer to say...
The court could you know, basically require the state to show cause.
Perhaps that could be a mechanism.
Okay.
But I think the strictures on those types of arguments and those types of showings are very strong, Ron. And I think the case law that we've set out makes that very clear, and I think the Superior Court understood that to be very clear.
Well, let's make sure we all understand the issue in this case. If we go back to Justice Jacobs' question about the 99 out of 100 people and the statutory language being mandatory, this is not this record is not the case where 100 people could be charged and only 99 were charged. In fact, everybody was charged. The question is, after the 100 people were all charged, was there a problem in not making a motion for a continuance for the 100th person when you made a motion for a continuance for 99? Isn't that really this case? Or something.
Well, we certainly didn't make it. First of all, Your Honor, the quote standard continuance doesn't mean every person who comes forward gets this opportunity. What happens is that...
No, I understand that, but trying to focus on what we need to decide and what we don't need to decide, we don't need to decide whether the statute means you have to charge everyone when you get a notice for motor vehicle, because this person was charged.
Correct.
So that's not her problem. The problem she's raising is that after she was charged, the conduct against her was inconsistent with the way the state proceeded against others.
And that is what she is claiming, and I'd suggest that those claims are very, very limited in scope, and that is equal protection and the like that we've spoken about. Certainly not, I don't like that the state read my record a certain way and read somebody else's record that I think is the same, a different way.
Does the record reflect, and I found it in Judge Abelman's decision, that It was in February 2008 that a prior petition was dismissed. Does
yes.
the record reflect why that was done?
I believe, Your Honor, if I recall, it does not. I do know what happened was that in that first petition, and by the way, she was referred to the Attorney General four times. You can look at her record, I believe Judge Abelman makes that finding also. But if you look at her driving record, she was referred four times. The third time the state filed the petition, that was the petition that got dismissed in February, she asked for continuance for counsel, which is not unusual. During that period, there must have, I do not know why, but there was a review of her case, and the state actually initiated the dismissal. It wasn't anybody else.
So if that, at least one way to look at that is as a continuance of the matter for more than 6 months?
Well, more than 6 months, Your Honor. In fact, she had a better, she got a better deal than the six-month continuance. She didn't have to do anything. It was flat-out dismissed.
Is that the break that the deputy AG told the judge?
I'm sure it is, Your Honor, and I can tell you, one, by speaking to him, but two, if you look, that's correct. The thing was submitted. I mean, he's talking about that prior incident. He's talking about the fact that it got dismissed. And again, that was far greater relief than she would have gotten here. It wouldn't have been hanging over her head. It was gone. Until she drove some more and drove poorly.
Well, but the legal point that's important for us to come to grips with, if you look at the Superior Court's opinion and discretion and not having discretion, is the distinction I'm trying to focus on between the charging decision, which we've said in many cases is an executive decision, separation of powers, and the Attorney General, the executive, has the power to make the charging decision. But once the matter is in court, then the court is involved also.
Yes.
And that the Attorney General's discretion is not dispositive. It's the Attorney General's application based on the court's reaction to whatever they apply for.
That's absolutely true, Your Honor. It is not dispositive. The court has to be involved. I would suggest, however, that when the court is trying to look at the Attorney General's requests, that the Attorney General actually saying, we've brought this action and we are now asking for the dismissal. The underlying thinking in asking for that continuance is still an executive function. And really, I believe that's where we're
going. It's not one that mandates deference. It's like in a civil proceeding, you can dismiss your complaint before the other side answers the complaint. But once the issues have been joined and you're in court, if somebody wants to proceed in a certain direction, you have to ask the court if you
yes.
can do it.
It is not one that gets full deference. It's also, I suggest respectfully, though, not one that allows the court to then engage in an analysis, that comparative analysis of, I don't think this person deserves to be an habitual criminal or habitual driving offender, which is what occurred here.
Fine. Thank you. See, you needed your 3 minutes after all.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I understand the court is focusing more on the second issue. However, it's important, it's actually rather critical regarding the misrepresentation as to the standard of review that this court employs. We agree, as Justice Holland indicated, Judge Abelman, in her opinion, her holding of a misunderstanding, that may be plausible. Certainly, that might be a plausible account of what occurred in the colloquy. The problem is the standard of review actually indicates that the factual findings of the Court of Common Pleas that are supported by the record are going to be upheld even if the Superior Court, if sitting and or acting independently, would have reached a contrary result. So because the Court of Common Pleas made a logical finding that when she asked a direct question to the Attorney General, why couldn't you do that for Ms. Anderson, and the question was, we had already done that, that was inaccurate. And that's what the Court of Common Pleas found. What the state doesn't also indicate in their briefing is that this occurred immediately after a standard continuance was rendered. The Attorney General was called up to sidebar as soon as the judge gave the standard continuance and therefore asked, why couldn't you do that? So before we defer to the Superior Court, it's the Court of...
Is it your position that the judge could have given a standard continuance on her own?
Yes, we believe so. Absolutely.
Why didn't you?
The record reflects that the judge felt that the statute also restricted her. What the record also reflects is that she was conflicted by what was going on. As the state also explains, this happened after Anderson was made the habitual offender. So it's safe to assume the judge is going through the calendar and starting to piecemeal together the fact that the state, having no discretion in these hearings, is abusing the discretion, and here you have a pro se litigant who's not represented, doesn't have anybody to argue on her behalf, essentially not get the standard continuance that really the state shouldn't be deciding who gets one and who doesn't.
Well, help me understand with the, ultimately the judge denied the petition completely, correct?
Correct.
But the judge could have said, I'm vacating it and I'm granting I'm rescheduling this matter for when I'm next available to hear it. And that's 6 months from now. Could she have done that?
Yes, I see my time is up, if I can answer Your Honor's question.
Yes.
Actually, Your Honor, she did something very similar to what you're suggesting. If we review the order that she issued when she vacated the original order in chambers, she asked the Attorney General to resubmit the petition at a later time before her. The Attorney General felt it was more appropriate to appeal the issue, and that's the route they took. But they could have resubmitted the petition, which is what the judge wanted them to do.
Thank you. Thank you both. The court will take this matter under advisement. We'll also take a brief recess.